Our memory makes us what we are. It's the key to our personal history and our sense of self. It's as unique to each person as our fingerprints. While we complain about it endlessly when it fails us, we couldn't walk down the street, open a door, or say a word without it. To find out more about some of the many facets of memory, we've contacted Rebecca Rupp. She holds a PhD in cell biology, and she's the author of Committed to Memory, How We Remember and Why We Forget. She joins us this morning from Vermont. Hello, Becky.
Hi, Lisa. How are you?
Good, thanks. I've been talking about memory as if it's just one thing, but people who study memory divide it up in different ways. What are those different ways?
All kinds of different ways. You know, actually, we tend to say my memory and think of it as a big, seamless kind of lump, but actually, it's a collection of sort of discrete operating systems that researchers divide up depending on its size, its staying power, its content. For example, there's episodic memory, which is sort of our little personal time machine. You know, the memories of things that have happened to you over the course of your life. You know, your sixth birthday party, where you went to school, how you met your mate, that kind of thing. And then there's semantic memory, which is what you use to play Trivial Pursuit. It's sort of your encyclopedia of facts, your mental test armament. Then there's procedural memory, which is learned skills, you know, how to swim, how to ride a bicycle, how to play the violin, if you can do that. So there's quite a battery of different categories of memory based on what's in the memory, what's in the pot. And then there are divisions of memory that are based on how long does it last. You know, short-term memory is absolutely notorious. Short-term memory only lasts a few minutes. That's the memory that you're using when you go and you look a phone number up in the phone book and somebody distracts you and then you've forgotten it before you get to the telephone. Short-term memory is limited and volatile. And from short-term memory, info either vanishes forever or it can gradually be processed into long-term memory, and maybe the stuff that you actually hang on to, certainly for a long time and possibly for the rest of your mortal days.
So how do we even know that these different kinds of memory exist?
Well, you know, a lot of this, there are a number of different kinds of research. Certainly there's work that's done with animals in laboratories. But then there are a lot of observations that are made with individuals who have various kinds of memory disorders. For example, in sorting out the difference between episodic and semantic memory, there was actually a patient. Most of the psychological patients are just known by initials. So we have these a guy named KC who was in a motorcycle accident and essentially lost all his memories of his personal past. His semantic memory, you know, his basic knowledge of facts and figures was totally intact, but he couldn't remember, you know, he knew what a Christmas tree was, but he couldn't remember incidents of family Christmases. He could certainly identify animals, but he could not remember himself having had a pet, that kind of thing. There's a very famous patient known as H.M. who, following surgery, lost the ability to process memories from short-term memory into long-term memory. So, in effect, he lives in a perpetual present where every 10 minutes or so, knowledge vanishes because he can't preserve it. Did you see the movie Memento?
I did, actually. Yeah. Tell us about that. What is that an example of one of these types of memory loss?
Yes, that would be info can no longer be processed from short-term into long-term memory. So he kept coping with it by continually taking pictures of things, taking notes, you know, trying to preserve his memory time stream, which kept vanishing out from under him every few minutes. I can't imagine coping with this. Officially, that would be known as anterograde amnesia, which means you've had some sort of event, an surgery, an injury, some kind of happening, that means that you can't form memories after the event. The kind of amnesia that you see all the time that explains the plots in murder mysteries is usually retrograde amnesia. You know, you're fine right now and you're forming memories normally, but you can't remember a swatch of your past.
Is there one area of the brain that's critical for memory?
Well, memory is actually pretty dispersed all over the place in the brain. However, there are some segments of the brain that are crucial for processing short-term memories into long-term memories. Like right over your ear and about an inch and a half into your head, there's an organ called the hippocampus. And the hippocampus and the temporal lobes of your brain, which are also on the sides, are essential for processing short-term to long-term memories. So lose those and you become solely a short-term person.
You've talked about some of the effects of memory disorders, but even among, I think, all of us, memory is notoriously unreliable. Why is that? Why is it that some of the things that, what are the things that interfere with our ability to store our memories accurately?
Oh, memory can be evil. You know, it's we depend on it, it's serviceable, it's a marvelous construct, but memories can be buried, they can be invented, they can be rewritten and twisted out of shape, they can disappear altogether. So there are a number of things that can happen. For one thing, we tend to rewrite our personal memories over time. You know, the brain, they say that it simultaneously has a archival and a mythmaker function. And the mythmaker function is to retell your stories the way you want them to be, the way you think they are, the way you, in view of your present beliefs or moods or rewriting your past. Then some memories are just plain disappear. And there's a lot of debate over why do we forget things? The most conventional argument is that some memories simply decay. There's a curve of forgetting that can show that any new information that you've learned within the first hour after internalizing this stuff, about half of it is already gone. Then there's an argument that interference accounts for a lot of our lost memories. If you have repetitive events, for example, they crowd each other out. It's like looking at a flock of penguins. You can't pick one of these repetitive events out of the mass. It's like, what did you have for lunch 6 months ago on Tuesday? You know, you simply can't differentiate this from all the other lunches you've had along the way. Unless, of course, that Tuesday happened to be a perfectly spectacular day for you. It was your birthday. You were celebrating your Nobel Prize. Landmark events make memories stand out, certainly. Did that help?
Absolutely. It did, very much. Explain some mysteries. When something traumatic happens to you as a child, some adults remember, but a surprising number forget. Do we know what explains the difference?
You know, we don't actually, but there are a number of theories. One suggestion for how trauma is remembered is that there are, you can generally divide trauma victims into two different types. And one type of trauma victims are the survivors of one single, unique, awful event. You know, you've been kidnapped. You were present when a bomb went off. You know, something really dreadful has happened one time. And these people tend to have a problem in that they have vivid recall of this incident. In fact, that can be a problem. The second type of trauma victim are people who, like survivors of child abuse, people who have been subjected to sort of multiple event abuse over a long period of time. And one theory is that they're actually, these people actually do blanket out. It's a forgetting that's a survival mechanism, basically, when you're just being subjected to too much mental pain to cope. So your brain tries to sweep it under the rug.
Smell is a tremendously potent trigger for memories. Why is that?
You know, doesn't this always bring up an incredible memory for you? You know, Lily of the Valley, perfume is your grandmother's house, that kind of thing. They say there's absolutely no short-term memory with smell. And the theory is that smell goes directly from our nose to the brain's olfactory bulb, which is physically located, it's in close juxtaposition to the limbic system, which is all our emotions, and the hippocampus, that little doohickey over the ear that functions in memory processing. And so this juxtaposition means that smell can very quickly mobilize a whole battery of memory associations. I think smell is absolutely fascinating. You know, in researching this book, I came over, you know, more examples of people who had smell memory examples. Charles Dickens, for example, said that, you know, he just loathed the scent of paste from having to work in a bottle factory as a kid and slap labels on bottles. And ever afterwards, I guess, paste, the smell of this stuff would plummet him back to this miserable period in his life.
And what about faces and names? Why is it that faces are so easy to remember and names are so easy to forget?
Oh, names are absolutely miserable. There's a wonderful story about Thomas Beecham, conductor and founder of the London Philharmonic Orchestra. And he met a woman in a Manchester hotel, the story goes, whom he recognized immediately, knew he knew this face, but could not remember her name. And so, you know how you amps around in a conversation, trying to get clues so that you will finally figure out who this person is. At last, he remembered that she had a brother. So he asked if her brother was well and if he was still pursuing the same line of work. And she said, "Oh, yes, my brother is very well and still king." So, you know, we can get into dreadful trouble with them. One of the theories as to how this works, based on people keeping journals of who they've met, who they've recognized, what they knew about them, and did they remember their name, seems to indicate that there's a sort of hierarchy of information processing when it comes to remembering names. First, you get facial recognition, which we seem primed to do. You know, even newborns respond to face patterns. So, you know, we're very quick at knowing whether this is a familiar face, is this a face I've never seen before. So, wham, recognition. The next step is the retrieval of all the biographical info that goes with this face. You know, that's my kid's second grade teacher. She raises canaries. She jogs. You know, all the battery of stuff you know about this person. And then last and hardest to get at is the person's proper name. And there are, you know, a number of guesses as to why names are just so particularly difficult for us. One suggestion is that names are unique. You know, names only apply to one specific person, and so we just may not have enough connected memory triggers to easily get us at that name. And another theory is that names don't mean anything. You know, Rowena Jones is essentially just a string of syllables. And they did, there were a couple of studies done where they found that people remember names much better if, for example, the name has some other association, like if your last name is Cook or Baker or Carpenter. So you just get an extra little memory nudge there. So that seemed to help. But the name problem is ubiquitous. There's even a name for people who chronically have a syndrome where they chronically forget names. It's called onomastic aphasia. And I think most of us are convinced we've got it. There's an old edition of, well, I guess they're all fairly old, edition of Emily Post's etiquette books from the turn of the 20th century. And one section in it was, "The retort courteous to one you have forgotten." So I keep meaning to write down exactly what that retort courteous is, because...
And that would be helpful to have stored away for when needed.
No kidding. Though I am so sorry. I simply can't remember your name. Seems to work fairly well.
It does. Well, thank you for joining us this morning, Rebecca.
Oh, you're entirely welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Rebecca Rupp joined us this morning from Shaftesbury, Vermont. She is the author of Committed to Memory, How We Remember and Why We Forget.